Okay, getting started. We are on the topic of memory management. There's a bunch of stuff in memory management. We looked at the first one, which is paging. And the takeaway in paging is you have So I need a scheme by which all addresses generated by the CPU are logical addresses. They're kind of meaningless. That's not how memory is organized. I have chopped up the address space of one process into pages. I've scattered these pages into RAM into various frames, and they're not contiguous. And then I have built a page table which consists of a sequence of frame numbers, one frame number per page. And I've arranged them so that page 0 goes to the topmost entry, page 1 goes to the next entry. And so as I'm running on every memory access, I'm going to replace the page number part of the logical address by the frame number, creating the actual physical address in memory. That's all. And that's a conversion trick that has to be done on every memory fetch, because the CPU doesn't know the RAM addresses. RAM works with RAM addresses, CPU works with logical addresses. Logical addresses are zero to a number for each process. Each process looks identical in its logical address, although the contents are different. And so the page table for each process is going to be different. So the actual allocation of memory depends on the page table. Does that part make sense? So then we worry about how large is this page table. So back of the envelope calculation. So let's say page size is 1K bytes. And let's say the size of the memory of a process is, that's pretty small, but I'm using 1 megabyte. The number of page table entries is equal to so in this example, it's 1,000. But 1 megabyte is too small, really, for most processors today. They run into hundreds of megabytes. So it'll run into hundreds of those. 100K, maybe the page size, 100K entries. Each entry is multiple bytes. And in this example, the address space would be offset, how many bits in the offset? In this example, how many bits will there be in the offset?
Zero.
No. Every address is split into offset and page number. And this is a fixed size split. It's system-wide, this is the split. How many bits in the offset? Yeah. 10. 10 for this case. And if it was 512, it would have been 9. If it's 4 kilobytes, then it will be 12. But that number is fixed on a per processor type thing. So Intel has a fixed page size. I forget. I think it's 4 kilobytes or is it 4 megabytes? Anybody want to look it up? And of course, if you need 1 megabyte, you will also need 10 bits in the physical, in the page size. But of course, it's going to be more. So the page size, this whole address size is whatever the number of bits that the CPU address size is. So it'll be 32 bits in the case of a 32-bit architecture, 64 bits in the case of a 64-bit architecture. 32-bit architectures are simpler to talk about, so let's talk about 32-bit architectures, in which case 22 bits will be the page number field, and 10 bits will be the address field. Should we really make page numbers large, page sizes larger than 1 kilobyte? Probably. Could even be a megabyte. Why should we make the page sizes larger? The larger page sizes reduces the size of the page tables significantly, and page table size is a problem, so maybe larger page sizes are better. You have less entries, you have less contention there, but larger page sizes also means larger wastage because of internal fragmentation. Half a page of every process or every segment, we haven't talked about segments, will be wasted on the average because nothing is an integral number of pages when you're talking about software and data and code and heap and all that stuff. Okay? So there is this compromise on how big the pages should be. So we kind of went with 1 kilobyte pages just for that example bit. Now, if we are talking about 1,000 entries or 10,000 entries or 100,000 entries in the page table, that's too big to put into the MMU. Because every time you do a context switch, you will have to flush this entire thing and reload it. And even if you had that much memory in the MMU, the context switch time will be very large. And page tables have other dynamic things like they may grow or shrink, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So every time you do a memory fetch, which is a fetch a piece of data from memory, or read or write data, you'll have to do a page table lookup. The page table is in memory, so you're going to do a memory fetch to do the page table lookup. And then you will do the data lookup because you've translated, you've replaced the page number with the frame number, and then you do another lookup to get the data you're looking for, so you'll be doing two memory lookups per lookup. and that makes the speed go down by 50%, which is not acceptable. Okay? So that's the downside of paging. The upside of paging is that I've gotten rid of fragmentation, I've gotten rid of contiguous memory allocation, I can put any process anywhere in main memory, not have to worry about it. All process spaces are very well organized. The compile time, you know, is going to start at memory location zero, so you can link and load faster. You can do static assignment of addresses at link time. That way, code runs faster. There's a whole bunch of advantages, but this thing about, that's a problem. So that problem is overcome by the use of So I want something in my MMU So what's the MMU? I think I've gone over it. Memory management unit. It's a piece of hardware sitting between the CPU and the memory and the RAM. MMU's job is to do the translation and fetch things from it. When we started this class, we talked about protection. We had a very rudimentary MMU that checked the bound and the base register to make sure you did not run out of protected memory spaces. Now the MMU has expanded to a much more complex thing, which does the page table lookup, which replaces page numbers with frame numbers. And we need the MMU because this little bit of bit twiddlery that it has to do cannot be done in software. That's too slow. It has to be done in hardware. It's a simple operation. We hard code this into a piece of logic circuitry, which keeps doing it on every CPU cycle. And in that translation scheme, it needs to look at memory to get the page table. So we should put the page table in the MMU. That has its downside. So we'll put a part of the page table in the MMU. And this part, which part? Well, it has to be dynamic. The MMU will figure out which part of the page table should be in memory. And it'll be pieces and parts from all over the page table. And then it becomes a problem with indexing. So we use a type of memory called cache memory. I know you're familiar with cache memories and their associativity and all that stuff, but I'm sure you'll say, I don't know. It's called content addressable memory. Does that ring a bell? It's not random access memory. What's the difference between cache and RAM? The cache, the same thing as RAM. Cache is faster, so okay, it's made of static RAM. Can we just use faster RAM for a cache, which is exactly built the same way as the RAM for memory? And the answer is no. Why not? Because it's not addressable. What does that mean? Okay, I'll come to that. So we put this TLB, which is a cache. The data cache and the instruction cache, there are three kinds of caches at least on modern systems: data cache, instruction cache, and TLB. They're all built approximately the same way. It's just different names for different pieces. Can we all merge these things together? Maybe. I'm not a hardware engineer. Why do they use different types? I don't know. But there are three kinds of caches, and they're operation-wise, concept-wise, they're very much the same thing. So now, how does a TLB work? It works like a cache. There's a bunch of caches, fully associative caches and some other caches. I'll water it down a little. and say that, look, a cache has to be designed as follows. I have 6 entries in my page table, 0 through 5. Incoming requests to do translations will give me a page number. I want to translate that page number to the frame number. And the frame numbers here, let's say for the heck of it, are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So this 5 must become a 15. How do I know that? I'll have to go get this entry. So if I go get this entry from memory, it's expensive. I do it once. I go get this memory from this, and I put 15 here. Then next time, and I go out to page 15. The next time the request comes, it comes for page 3. It's not in the cache. So I look up 3, it's 13, I put it in the cache. Okay? Next time the request comes for 5, I don't look at the memory, I look at the cache, it's in 15. So let's say I'm heavily using page 5 and 3, that's loaded into the cache. Now I've got 2 entries in the cache, and I never have to go back to the page table and do an expensive operation. That's the whole point in caching. But I've got 15 and 13 in the cache. They correspond to 5 and 3. How does the cache know that these are... How does the memory know that this is 0, this is 1? These are addresses. These are array indices. You add the base address to this, and you can easily calculate which slot. This is very nicely, sequentially, contiguously placed in memory. That's not. That's a part of the memory in some haphazard order. So how do we find, next time I want 5 is in the cache? You know that these numbers are not stored in memory. These numbers are. So if you just store the memory numbers into the cache, it's not going to work. You need to store the indices also. So that means that in the cache, I'll have to store 5 and 3. So the cache has 2 fields, an address field and a data field. And when I say 5, it has to go, yes, I have it, because I have the value 5 in my address field. And hence, the cache is called called associative memory. And that means that it doesn't have addresses. Addresses are soft designed in the sense that the contents of the cache determine the address. So 5 and 3 are addresses in that cache. The address 2 doesn't exist in the cache. So if you ask for page number 2, we will have to go to memory, get it, put it in the cache, and do the translation. Next time you ask for page number 2, it will be in the cache. The cache will say, yes, I have it. So you check with the cache first. The MMU checks with the cache first. Cache says, I have it. We go fast. Cache says, I don't have it. Then I have to load the cache till it says, I have it, and it becomes much slower. So there are now 2 things. I have a fast path where if I have a cache hit, then it said, yes, I have it, then it goes fast because you get the translation from the cache. If it's a cache miss and it's not in the cache, I have to load it to cache. Why is loading slow? Loading involves looking up the memory. Memory is slow. I want to avoid going to memory as much as possible. So I have to go to memory, it's slow, I pay the price, but now that it's loaded in cache, next time it'll be a hit. So we talk about cache hit ratios. How many times did you go to cache and how often was it a hit? The higher the hit ratio, the better it is, the better the performance. Hit ratio will be, in general systems, it's quite a bit higher than 90%, but what does it depend on? How would you ensure that your hit ratio is high? The two things. One is you should be reusing the same addresses over and over again. That's called locality. Wonderful news is that all programs are very localized. That is, they reuse the same data and same pieces of code over and over again because they run in loops. And they are constantly using a counter called count and a while something, and it goes down round and round. So they're localized to certain small set of pages, hence a lot of the cache things are getting reused. And this set of reuse is not too large, but your cache must be bigger than the amount of pages that's being constantly reused. So larger caches are better. And larger caches are worse because then there's a lot of misses in the beginning and all kinds of things. So this is also an engineering design issue, how big should be your cache. Now your cache is also expensive because how do you know, how does the cache decide whether it's a hit or a miss? Sounds very easy, but it's not. So I've got a cache with three fields, what did we say? Five, three, and one, let's say. And in comes a request for three. Is this a hit? Yes. How do you know? It'll go like, I can see three is in there. Okay, you can see three is in there. What if there were 1,000 entries? Then would you see three is in there? Not so easily, but as a human being looking at it, we could. How does a piece of hardware figure out what's in there and what's not? What would be the obvious answer? Pardon?
Searching it, yes.
Searching it. How do you do a search? You've got 1,000 numbers. You're going to look at this. It's going to take too much time. I want you to search in nanoseconds. How do you do that?
Can't you keep track of what you put into the cache?
What does that mean? You have a list of what you put in the cache. Now don't you have to hunt through the list?
Sure. If you sort them, you can use a binary search.
Okay, you can sort them. So now we need sorting hardware, and when you do a binary search. And every time there's a change, I have to rebuild the tree. These things change. How about much faster than a binary search? Yeah?
If our cache is at 1,000 spots anyway, don't we want to make a new cache that's even smaller than that? Or so to speak?
What does that mean? I want 1,000 entries. Generally, it's more like 100,000 entries. But I want 1,000 entry cache.
Okay.
You want to make it smaller? Yes, the searching speed will be higher. Your hit ratio will be much lower. Yeah.
Can we use red flag trees to keep everything?
That's again tree. Okay, that's like a binary tree, and it's a balanced tree, and you've got to do all that, plus every search will at least take logarithm time. I want zero time. Yeah.
Can we do predict search?
Okay. I do not want to do a search. I don't want three or four operations in there. Yes.
Use a hash
function. Again, I have to calculate a hash function, find, then it'll miss, then it'll go somewhere else. This is hardware. I've got to keep it very simple. And obviously, there is no good answer. The only answer is a parallel search. Build a circuitry that instantly compares the incoming bits with all the bits there in parallel. Put in as many comparators as there are bits in the address field of the cache. Isn't that complicated? Yes. Why do you think caches are expensive? They are huge in terms of area, in terms of power consumption, in terms of price to manufacture, because you are having a parallel search within one cycle, much less than one cycle of a memory, to find whether you have a number in there or not. Okay? So caches are not like random access memory where you have an address decoder and you light up the line. This is like entire thousands and thousands of entries are being searched all together, not one by one. And that way I don't have to organize it. I don't have to keep trees. I don't have to sort algorithms. I don't have to balance. Algorithm is very simple, but the hardware structure is expensive to build. Okay, that's a simple example of how actual caches have much more rules of organizing, so that it's kind of cheaper to build but a little bit slower, and there's some false positives and false negatives, but conceptually this is what's going on. There's a parallel search which gives lights up and says hit or miss instantly, and if it's a miss you go to memory. If it's a hit, it immediately comes back with the answer. So the caches are typically not as big as the page tables, because otherwise you just load the page table into the MMU and you're done. That takes too much time. You're going to keep the caches smaller because the locality property says that you just use only a few pages, even though your program has this enormous number of memory pages. Typically when it runs, it just uses 1/10 of it. So 1/10 of a size of cache is good enough. It's expensive and power hungry. But you cannot a priori design hardware that will work with any kind of software applications that somebody throws at it. So how does this cache work? It starts off as empty. Every time a process is context switched in, you have an empty cache. Every time cycle. Not like once a process is started, it's got a cache. There's only one cache in hardware. There's hundreds and hundreds of processes. So every time a process is context switched out, we clean out the cache because that's old information, can't be used. So when a process starts executing in its time cycle, it runs a little slow. It's loading up the cache. Then it speeds up. Then it creates more cache misses. As it has cache misses, caches start filling up. What if the cache is full? You can fall back to say, cache is full, we will now just go to memory whenever there's a cache miss and continue that way. But that will be a stale cache. Maybe your working set has changed. Maybe you're using a different page over and over again that's not in the cache. So every time there's a cache miss on a full cache, something gets thrown out and this new one gets put in. And that works better. But the big problematic question here is, you're going to throw out an old one? Which one? Least recently used. Least recently used cannot really be implemented. So I'm going to postpone this whole discussion of how to do cache replacement when we talk about page replacement, which uses the same set of algorithms. Least recently used has a problem that means you've got to tag every cache entry by the time it was used last. And that means every time you use a cache, you've got to go fetch the clock, tag it. That gets to, yeah.
What if you start from the beginning?
That's FIFO. That has its problems too. Because you just keep it, and as you drop off the end, you roll it back, you're done. FIFO has always problematic. So yeah, least recently used is considered a good one, but it's a little bit dicey to implement. So there are some middling ground things which can be done. So this discussion we will revisit, because the same problem with page replacement. And there, by then we'll have a lot more arsenal to deal with it. And cache replacement strategies are designed by the hardware people who build the machines. Page replacement strategies are an operating systems thing. So we'll talk about page replacement, and then we can draw it back to cache replacement. So under the assumption that cache hit takes no time, we can say that the average speed of memory access really depends on memory cycle time. At best, it can be equal to memory cycle time, but it's worse than memory cycle time because it's a fraction of the memory cycle time and a lower fraction of twice the memory cycle time, because you're doing two memory accesses whenever you're getting a cache miss, and the cache is taking zero time. So the higher H is, the lower 1 minus H will be, and you'll asymptotically get closer to one memory cycle time rather than two memory cycle times. Okay? That's simple enough.
Does the dot represent multiplication?
Yeah, dot is multiplication.
Oh. And why use times?
Oh, well, okay. Okay. So why are we pushing paging? Paging, I started with this fragmentation problem. that main memory, contiguous allocation, dynamic, things are leaving, things are coming in, we get lots of little pieces all over the place, and it's fragmented memory. And we cannot do compaction and things like that. So let's just make it all fixed size allocation, which is in terms of pages, and we have fragmentation. Then we go like, look, there's more. There is protection, there is sharing, there is growth. And having said that, I'll show you how. Having said that, we'll go back, revisit these three and say, this is really not as good as it sounds. Paging does not really, it provides protection, but the other two are a little iffy. Protection, it says, a process so 0, 1, 2, 3 are three page table entries, and these are the three pages it can access. This is page 0, this is page 1, this is page 2. The only way you can access RAM is through the page table. There are three entries in the page table pointing to three points in RAM. You cannot access any other frames in memory from this process because it's not visible. You have no way of generating an address that points somewhere else. You can generate an address whose page number is higher than 2, and then you look up some arbitrary junk in near your page table and go to an illegal address, but that is easy to check in the MMU. You're only allowed to go up to a certain page number. So this size is, all you've got to do is to make sure that you check size. And that way you get complete protection that all your RAM that belongs to other people is not accessible by the process that it's running. So memory gets protected. Can the process mess with the page table? The page table is, again, in one of these locations that's not accessible. So it cannot mess with the page table. How does the operating system do it? That's a much more difficult question to answer. We'll leave it for now. The easy answer is the operating system runs in physical memory and doesn't use paging, so it has access to everything. But that's not how it's done. So we get protection, we get lack of fragmentation. Sharing says, what if the two processes that are actually using the exact same code? Do I have to load the code twice in RAM, or can I reuse the code? In case of physical memory systems, you cannot. Each process has to contain itself, whole thing. So if you load this one has the same code because you're running two windows of Chrome or Firefox or Word or whatever, they're the exact same code. The code gets loaded twice or three times in physical memory systems. In paging systems, we may be able to fix that. What we do in paging systems is that so I've got two pages of code for process one. I've got some pages of data for process one. The data pages are here. Fine? When process two starts up, it has its own page table, and the page table for entries of these two are the same, this page table entry points to the same frame of data, this page table entry points there, the data entries point to some other places. So now notice that the code is the exact same copy for both processes. I did not load the code twice. I pointed to the same pages of code from two different page tables. And that's sharing. Little downside is I have to make sure that the code is an integral number of pages. That is, at the end, if there's space left over on that page, I cannot allocate data there. I have to page align things. But once I page align things, I can do this. And now if I have hundreds of processes running a web browser, there'll be only one copy of the web browser in the thing. It's not threads, it's processes. It's completely separate address spaces. Yet, there is no overlap. There's no double loading of stuff in memory. That's another advantage. Growth says, if you have allocated so many pages per process, you have a page table containing that many pages pointing out elsewhere. Now, page tables are pieces of data structure in the kernel. If you want to allocate more memory to that process, increase the size of the page table, you'll get more memory. And that way you can do growth. In case of physical memory systems, you might be bumping against some other process. So you cannot grow that. But here, I can just grow the page table. If the page table is bumping against some other page table, I can just remove that page table from there, put it elsewhere. I can move page tables around. I can do compaction. So growth is no problem. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, having said that, this whole thing about sharing and growth are somewhat lies, and that's what we'll tackle next. So I lied. Firstly, the paging scheme is a very arbitrary thing. You've got a program, you chop it out into 1 kilobyte pages. Why 1 kilobyte? That's what the hardware architecture says, but that's not what the software says. Your software is a highly structured thing. You've got the code part, which has various libraries, various functions, various things. You have the data part, which has different pieces of data belonging to different modules of the program. You've got stacks, you've got heaps, you may have multiple stacks if you're running processes. You may have one heap. People talk about multiple heaps for reasons, but there's a lot of structure in a program. This whole structure is ignored. It's just cut into arbitrary pieces based on size. And size is not something programmers have any clue about. You don't write a program saying, oh, I think I'm over a page now. Okay? You don't even know what a page is. at least for a programmer. So that's kind of arbitrary. And that leads to problems with sharing. I said sharing is really easy. Sharing is really easy if you do only sharing of code in its entirety. Anything else, I want to share a module, I want to share a library, I want to have shared memory across processes, only this part, all that is either not possible or very complicated, or just the interfaces between the programmer and the memory cannot be handled. There is no growth. I kind of showed that growth is easy. It's a complete lie. Why? You've got a piece of program, process. And it's initially given so much memory as this box. Now you're supposed to put code, data, heap, and stack there. Where would you put code, data, heap, and stack? What are your options of putting those things? I have four pieces to put in there. I could start with the code at the bottom or code at the top. Same story. I could put code and data or data and code. These are fixed size pieces. So none of this matters. I put it in. They don't need growth. So I put, let's say, code here. I put data here. Now I've got the stack which grows upwards and heap which grows downwards. What am I going to do? Well, I could. The standard way of handling these things are over allocate memory in this initial chunk, put the heap here, it'll grow down, put the stack here, it'll grow up. And if the two hit each other, you're dead. Okay? You can't run any further. So, the fix to that is make the whole space bigger earlier at initialization time. Because when it hits, it's too late to fix it then. You cannot move anything. But we said in paging, I can make this bigger. Oh yeah, I can. It serves no purpose. I have no use for this area. I cannot move the stack down. It's trying to get more space that way. I cannot make the heap crossover and go here. So this space, I can get growth, useless. I have to pre-allocate how much I need. Got it? So to address these things, and I am not going to spend much time on segmentation. Segmentation came and went conceptual sake, I'm going to spend a little time on segmentation. Segmentation is a memory management scheme which was like the paging problems. Can we fix the paging problems by using a scheme called segmentation? And we'll reinvent the memory management scheme and not use pages. So, the segmentation in a nutshell says a program, or rather process, has many independent segments. Not pages. And each segment is a logical So, for example, this could be a heap, this could be a stack. And this could be code, this could be data. Well, that's the same thing. Let's say in the code, we actually have several code segments. This is a library, this is a module, and this is the main. And in the data, instead of one, we have many completely separate segments of data consisting of data from module 1, data from module 2. So in end, I have a lot of segments. And these segments put together linearly in this order will let the program run. And each segment should have the ability to grow and shrink independently. They never bump into each other. And that's the brilliance of segmentation. How do we do it? I can show you how to do this. But then I have independent growth on segments, so I can make the stack larger, I can make the heap larger, I can have multiple stacks that don't bump into each other, I can have all this fun stuff. On top of that, I can share any two segments, any segment between multiple processes. In fact, I can share one segment from process A with the segment from process B so that they reuse the same RAM, and process A has another segment that it shares with process C. Any kind of sharing can be handled because the unit of allocation is a segment. Sounds too good to be true, but it can be done. And it does have downsides. The way this is done, that the process is broken into segment 0 has addresses 0 through N0. Independent from segment 1, which starts at address location 0, goes up to N1. Hence, by reallocating what is the value of N, I can increase the size of the segment. And so we have segment number. And this is segment offset. And to tie the whole thing together, we have a segment table. In the segment table, we have RAM address. So if this is the segment 0, then this will be segment 0 of process 1. And here are the addresses that correspond to that. So there'll be a segment table per process. The segment table will point to the beginning of a piece of RAM, there are no pages, which contains that segment. And this thing will be that's the logical segment, this is the physical segment. And you go, okay, I want to grow segment number 0. I want to make this part larger. Can I break this into two parts? No, it has to be contiguously allocated in memory. So what if it bumps into something? I can just move it somewhere else by just making one change to the segment table. These segments are not fixed in the memory where it is. Yes, it'll cost me overhead to move that segment. I can compact the memory and I'll have to change all the pointers, but I know where the pointers are coming from and I can do that housekeeping. So a lot of the problems of physical memory systems go away. But I still have the contiguous memory allocation problem, which is kind of a killer. So I can get sharing and I can get the growth, but I have to do contiguous memory allocation and I'll have fragmentation problems regardless, because compaction fixes fragmentation problems, but compaction is very expensive. And you pretty much have to freeze the system. Segmentation has been used in some older systems. It's not around anymore. But it's kind of a neat idea. But the advantages it offers in terms of sharing and growth, etc., is not that big a deal. So then people said that let's fix segmentation by using the paging is a brilliant scheme. Segmentation fixes all the problems of paging but brings back the fragmentation issues and memory allocation issues and contiguous allocation issues. Put the two together. Let's have the advantages of both segmentation and paging. Maybe I should say segmentation and paging, but anyway. So now just layer it up. As far as the process is concerned, it should look at memory like I'm running on a segmented system. I have a set of hundreds of segments out there in memory land. The memory, however, the RAM doesn't know anything about segments, it only has pages, frames. And there is a translator that takes every segment and converts it to a bunch of pages and scatters it all over memory. So now, no contiguous memory allocation. So to do this, the infrastructure needs would be, you're paging the segments. So one process will have one segment table and each entry, so this is S0, S1, S2, and there will be page table for S0, page table for S1, page table for S2. So three page tables, and the segment entry will point to the base of the page table for each of these segments, and the page tables will have pointers to frames of RAM. A little bit complicated there. So a process has one segment table. Each entry in that segment table is represented by a page table, and each entry in the page table is backed up by the frame. So verbally, talking about the translation scheme, when a process puts out a logical address, it consists of a segment number, page number, offset. We use the segment number to look at the segment table. We find the entry in the segment table. That way we find the page table that the segment contains. We use the page number to index into the page table. Then we find the frame number, we glue that with the offset, we've got the RAM address or physical address. It's the same thing as paging, one more step, and it gives you all the features that you possibly can need from memory management schemes. So that's the way to go. So why is that not the reality? Frankly, we don't need that much. Many years of looking at software by people, by software engineers, we've come to the conclusion that sharing and growth are not the big issues in software. There's enough memory there. If we can organize memory in a simpler way so that there is some sharing, some growth, limited amounts, we'll be fine. And we want to keep things a little simple. And on top of that, we haven't addressed the two issues of the stack hit meeting the heat, and we have never talked about where is the operating system. What's the memory space of the operating system? So can we find a kind of compromised engineered solution to the memory management problem that does a reasonable job on all fronts. And that was done. So we essentially what was done is we take this segmented paging thing and make some tweaks to it and oversimplify it, and we get what I term VAX memory architecture. VAX memory architecture, we are talking 1980, somewhere around 82, 83. This is seriously old stuff. People who did this are gone, the company is gone, the architecture is gone, but that design is still there on every CPU that we use today. And it says, what you do per process is not this unlimited number of segments, you need 4 segments. Actually 3 segments. You just give every process 3 segments. And the 2 segments for the use of the process, structured in a weird way that I'll show you in a minute, and the 3rd segment will contain the operating system so that every process has a shared copy of the operating system. And it can make direct calls into the operating system, it can see the operating system, but it cannot touch it, and everything becomes easy to understand, doable. The page tables are in virtual memory or logical memory in the operating system memory. The operating system can see every process, although it's shared. But it's if it's in the context of the process. Okay, I'm not making sense. So it says every process should have 4 gigabytes of space. You give it a 1 gigabyte segment called P0, 1 gigabyte segment called P1, 1 gigabyte segment of don't go there, and 1 gigabyte segment called sys, which contains the operating system. And then the 32-bit address, and this is really the 32-bit memory architecture of the Intel chip. 32-bit address has 2 bits here. 00 means P0, 01 means P1, and 10 is reserved, don't use it, and 11 is sys. And there is a page table for P0, there's a page table for P1, there is a page table for sys. So the sys page table points to frames where the operating system is stored, and the sys page table is the same page. Okay, there's no segment table. You don't need segment tables. You have 2 registers per process, which points to P0 and P1, 3 registers, 1 points to sys, and the sys is completely shared, so every process sees the same sys address space. P0 and P1 are completely separate for every process. P0 is a page table that grows downwards. That is, what you do is you put code, data, and heap in P0. and the heap is allowed to grow to 1 gigabyte. You do not allocate 1 gigabyte. You keep it much smaller in the page table. But if you need to, you can add entries into the page table. The P1 segment is upside down. It contains the stack, which grows upwards. So the page table is inverted. The top, the bottom, the page table can be grown upwards. It's just kind of hard to explain, but they invert the page table that it grows upwards, and these are the next indices. So it lower byte addresses. So if you need to add more to the page table, we'll add it on top, not at the bottom. And the pointer to the page table is here, and all the indices work by subtraction rather than by addition in hardware. Okay, so that way my stack can grow till a gigabyte. It cannot cross a gigabyte because it's crossing segments. But no process uses 2 gigabytes of memory. But people say there are some math and Bitcoin mining stuff that needs more than that. They go to 64-bit architectures. But majority of software runs fine on 32-bit architectures with 2 gigabytes of data space. Okay? So growth is no longer a problem. Heap can grow downwards, stack can grow upwards. If you make a system call, you're going into the sys space, and the sys space now can see the entire process space because you're part of the same context of the process, and the operating system can directly access buffers and all that of the user process that's running in the operating system because the map of the memory contains the entire process and the operating system. And the page tables are in the operating system, not in physical memory. That sits in the sys space. The only page table that's not in the sys space is the sys page. No, even the sys is in the page sys space. No, everything's in the sys space. And no, this is not page segmentation, but yes, it's page segmentation in a very limited way. So what about sharing? The sharing part is not fixed, but that has not really caused a problem. So growth is fixed, no sharing. I mean sharing, yeah, code sharing is done. You can share the entire code between. That's how when we run our systems, if you load multiple copies of the same process, it reuses the code. It doesn't reuse the memory and the heap because you should not. Does it share memory between processes? No. You can, there are ways, but it's a bit of a kludge. Okay, so that's how memory things work. Okay, any questions? Do I need to explain this a little better in some way? So this is the original design. I think Linux kind of sort of does it this way. Microsoft Windows operating systems puts the code at the bottom. I think both code and data go at the bottom and then the stack. Doesn't make any difference. That's fine too. And Linux also has a feature where instead of 2 gigabytes, you can have a 3 gigabyte space where there's a 2 gigabyte buffer in the middle. In some convoluted way, in that reserved space is used for the stack, and the heap can cross over into, or both can cross over or something. In the Intel architecture, there's a way of doing it. So Linux does a 3 gigabyte address space. Windows does a 2 gigabyte address space. And 1 gigabyte is completely reserved for the operating system. I'll take questions. We're not done with memory management. There is this whole thing of virtual memory. Whatever I've talked about till now is the entire thing with all these page tables, segment tables, whatever it is. At the end of the day, there was a pointer to RAM. That means the memory has to be in RAM. Virtual memory systems say memory doesn't have to be in RAM. And that throws in another spanner in the works. So we have to talk about memory management where memory doesn't have to be in RAM. Okay.
Something to the effect of like the process and the OS are in the same context, so they can share. What exactly did you mean by that?
So there's one process. It has code, data, heap, stack. It has the OS. Process 2 has code, data, stack, code, data, heap, stack, OS. These two are exactly the same copy. Mm-hmm. So when a process makes a call to the OS, like in a paging system, how does it call? Where does it go? What address does it use? We don't know. Here, it just calls an address in its own address space.
So
it goes in there. When it's running here, these addresses are still valid, so the OS can mess with the process. But if there's a context switch, this OS kind of slides over here and starts playing with this guy.
Okay. So this is because it's because there's caching and because
there's caching and all that is below. But the operating system is shared by all the processes.
Okay,
and it's in a separate area that slides as the processes context.
Because it's just sort of a physical memory system.
Yeah, you could.
It would be a difference.
Yeah, it would be a huge difference.
But see, here you need that sharing thing actually has a benefit.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Sir, we had a problem about project-wise degree. Well, we don't know why we only got 5 out of 10 at the thing.
Actually, now that I think about it, isn't the first project supposed to have a payload of like one single digit number or
one integer?
One integer, right?
Yeah.
Did it mention anything about like what digit it had to be, or was it just any one single integer?
Integer.
Okay, just
integer is a 32-bit value.
I just wanted to make sure. Thank you, but.
But, okay, so you lost points on the project, and I don't know why. So, I didn't grade it. So, the graders keep some notes on why they did the deduct project, water on project. So, just look up any one of them. Whoever graded it, but everybody should know.
So, there's like a rubric that we could check, or something like that?
There's no public rubric. They have something, so you got to essentially try sending an email. They might give you a response, or you can just drop by office hours.
And I keep forgetting, the email that we need to send this information to is on your site, or?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay, just one question.
Mm-hmm.
So the office hour is Wednesday, 2 to 3?
That's one of the of mine.
Yeah.
But graders have different office hours. It's all posted.
So the query is done by the TA?
Yeah. Oh. So I don't have access to that information.
So we have to ask the TA we did it wrong.
Uh-huh. Not the fellow who does recitation, the other people.
The other people?
Mm-hmm.
So who should I send email to?
Pick anyone.
out of a list of, but it's going to be emails on the cactus.eas.eu, I think.
Yeah, the emails are listed there. They're all ASU emails, yeah.
I guess that's all we really have to ask. I mean, I guess other than the simple question as to